Hello, and welcome to the MoneyWise podcast. Each episode, we'll get to the bottom of key personal finance news affecting your money. I'm Brianne Horn, a reporter at MoneyWise, and today I'm joined by MoneyWise editor, Rachel Rickard-Strauss.
Hi, Brianne.
Deputy editor, Sam Barker.
Hello.
And special projects editor, Rachel Lacey.
Hello.
Hello to you all. First, we're going to take a look at savings rates. Sam, it doesn't look like a promising picture for savers at the moment, does it?
Not at all, sadly, especially if you're an easy access saver, although there is some good news, which I will endeavour to end on a positive note. So the news this week was that more than a third of instant access accounts pay interest rates of 0.1% or less, and the figure is actually 34% of these deals pay this kind of disappointing level of interest. There is more than £176 billion of British savers' cash currently sat in these low-interest deals. And as listeners of previous podcasts will know, when numbers get into the billions, I think it helps to give some sort of context to those numbers. £176 billion is the same as the annual GDP of Greece, which is obviously a huge sum of money. And savers are caught very much between a rock and a hard place with this, because two things are going on which compound the effect of low interest on easy access savings deals. So on the one hand, the rates on these are falling. And on the other hand, there are more of us putting our money into them. So UK savers put £11 billion into easy access deals between the start of March and the end of April of this year. So that was four times as much as compared to the same period last year. And this is all from research by Paragon Bank. And for reference, £11 billion, the same as the annual GDP of the Republic of the Congo. So it's possible that many households have been spending less during lockdown, which has contributed to this increase in easy access cash inflows. But it's also likely that the worrying state of the world at the moment means that people value having a greater amount of their money close at hand in an easy access deal and not locked away in investments or in fixed term savings deals. Not only this, but many of these easy access accounts with very low rates also have strings attached. So if you were to take more than a handful of withdrawals a year, for example, from these deals, many of them would mean that you would no longer earn 0.1%. You would earn less than that, perhaps even nothing. Or one of the top easy access deals at the moment, you would need £10,000 to open, and that's from Yorkshire Building Society. And that's a sum that many savers might not have. So the main culprit here is high street banks, and understandably, because many of us value convenience when it comes to picking savings deals, very often if you have a current account with a high street bank, you'll get a message from your provider saying, would you like to open an interest paying savings account? Click here. That's all very convenient, obviously, but too often these linked savings accounts pay some of the lowest possible interest rates on the market. As a curious side note, it is now possible to get an easy access deal which pays more than a one-year fixed rate bond, which I think shows what a kind of topsy-turvy world savers live in at the moment. So what I'm thinking here is NS&I income bonds, which confusingly are an easy access account, pay 1.16%, and the top one-year bond from Ekano Bank pays 1.01%. So not a particularly rosy outlook for savers, I'm afraid.
For people who are looking to try and get a return at this point, the picture does look a bit dismal, but what can they do to get the rates that they're looking for?
Well, it's not all bad news, and savers shouldn't be disheartened, and there are a few reasons. So firstly, there's a value in saving. So we need to save our money somewhere, and an easy access deal remains an excellent place to do that. There is a value in saving for its own sake, because putting money away when it becomes a habit means that we don't give in to pessimism about, oh, why would I even bother saving? These rates are so low. And it becomes positive reinforcement. It reinforces the notion that this money is not for spending in the short term. It's for saving up as a financial buffer or for longer term projects. And then hopefully that habit will continue when easy access rates rise, which leads neatly on to, I guess, the second point, which is that one day these easy access rates will rise again. Much of the reason that they are low is a symptom of the Bank of England cutting its base rate to 0.1%, which is its lowest ever rate. And when that eventually rises, then savings rates will rise with it. Now, if rate is your focus, but you perhaps don't want to invest, there are still some options which don't look at all bad. So if you have £6,000 a year that you might be saving, then a regular saver deal from Coventry Building Society looks like a pretty tasty option. It would pay 1.85% on up to £6,000 a year. And taking out that deal means that you could potentially earn £111 a year in interest. So deals of that nature, regular savers, actually look pretty appealing at the moment.
So some people looking for great savings rates might come across providers that aren't that well known. Do you think it's worth them putting their money with these banks that they're not that sure about, or should they stick to more established brands?
I think that is a really interesting question, and it's definitely a symptom of the best buy tables at the moment, that a lot of the top deals are from little known brands. And there are a lot of savers who would say, you know, this is not a high street name, no, I've never heard of this company, do I trust it? And really, I think it comes down to the individual saver. It's definitely a commonly held view. And when I've spoken with people about this before, and particularly older savers, they remember the days of more savings deals being unregulated and the potential of losing money. So now anything in the best buy tables will be FSCS regulated. So if, even in the worst case scenario, which would be that company went bankrupt, your money would be protected up to £85,000. So the possibility of losing your money is kind of offset by that. I think some people would also look at little known providers and say, well, you know, does this mean that perhaps their customer service wouldn't be as good? And actually, I'm not convinced by that either, because I've had particularly poor customer service from my high street bank, and I'm sure that, you know, anyone listening to this has probably also had pretty poor service from a massive brand. And I think it comes down to someone's individual appetite as to how important the company being a household name is.
And back in 2007, 2008 sort of time, I was actually wooed by a very high interest rate on a bank that was new to the UK, which, don't know if anyone's memories go back long enough, was iSave, which was run by Landsbanki in Iceland. I can't off the top of my head remember how much interest it was paying, but it was, at the time, it was the best rate you could get. And customer service was brilliant. Everything was super slick. And then obviously we had the financial crisis of 2008. They came across a lot of problems, and they had to shut up shop. So it was quite a scary time, but I think it's worth mentioning that the money was covered by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. And we made our claim, and it was very easy. It was very straightforward, and we got every penny back. So I don't necessarily regret putting my money with iSafe, because we got a great bit of interest for a period of time, and, you know, I didn't lose any money. But it did have its scary moments, but I think people do have to put their faith in the protection that's available.
And that's really useful to know. The FSCS protection is a great safety net, and also gives people the confidence, I suppose, to try out new brands who potentially could become more well established as they get accustomed.
It was very quick, it was painless, and, you know, lots of people were pulling their money out, and I thought at the time, I was working for MoneyWise at the time, and I thought, do you know, I'm saying to people all the time in news stories, your money is protected. So I thought, you know, I've got to stand by this. And actually it was fine. And it wouldn't put me off putting money with a new name again, as long as the FSCS protection is there.
And what I would say to people who might be asking, well, you know, how do I know if that FSCS protection is there? If you scroll down to the bottom of the website of any provider you're looking at, it will normally say it right at the bottom of the homepage. So if you see it, then that's absolutely fine. If it's not there, beware, is what I would say.
Thanks, Sam. And now we're going to turn our attention to cash ISAs. Some new stats have come out. What is the latest?
Yes, so we got figures out today from HMRC on the latest individual savings account figures. And they're really good. They're quite comprehensive, and they show how many people have taken out cash ISAs, stocks and shares ISAs, what the difference is in the gender breakdown, in income breakdown. And there's lots of interesting things in there. So first of all, reassuringly, the nation is still in love with the cash ISA. And with ISAs in general. So the number of people who put money into an ISA in the last tax year, so 2018 to 19, was 11.2 million. And that is up from 10.1 million the year before. There were some thoughts that we might be going off ISAs, particularly because we have now the personal savings allowance, which allows you to earn up to £1,000, or if you're a higher rate taxpayer, £500 of interest tax-free every year anyway. So lots of people think, well, that renders the ISA a little bit redundant since that is its key attribute. However, it seems that people are sticking with their ISAs nonetheless. But what is slightly unnerving about them is, although overall the number of ISAs subscribed to last year went up, the proportion of those that were stocks and shares ISAs fell considerably. So actually there was a drop of 450,000 in the number of people paying into a stocks and shares ISA last year.
That's pretty significant.
It's a huge drop, isn't it? It's £5.2 billion less in stocks and shares ISAs. And it means that cash ISAs are well up as a proportion. So 76% of all ISAs that people put money into last year were cash ISAs, and that was only 70% the year before. A real hit to stocks and shares ISAs. There's been lots of commentary out today, people questioning what it was that turned people... a significant number of people against stocks and shares ISAs during that year. And if you think back, so we're talking April 2018 to April 2019, and the markets were pretty tumultuous. There's a lot of uncertainty about Brexit. You can see why people might be a little bit wary of putting their money into the stock market. However, as we all know, and all MoneyWise readers will know as well, when markets are down, it's not necessarily a bad time to invest. In fact, conversely, you're getting a good deal. And if you are investing regularly, then it doesn't really matter what's going on, what the levels of volatility are. If you just drip feed a small amount every month, you don't really have to worry about the markets flying all over the place. But it is nonetheless understandable that people might have been nervous during that year.
But if somebody does have a stocks and shares ISA and are on the edge about whether or not they should keep investing into it, what would your advice be for them?
I guess there's lots of things to consider. One is, if you're on the edge and you're not sure, cash versus stocks and shares, do both. So you've got a maximum allowance every year of £20,000, but you can split that however you like between the two, or indeed more if you fancy an innovative finance ISA or a lifetime ISA as well. So long as you don't go over 20,000 and you don't pay into more than one of each type every tax year, go with it. So that's one thing. Secondly, if you have a long time horizon, and if you are investing, you want a decade is good, 5 years perhaps, but you want a nice time horizon that you don't expect to have to touch your money, just ride it out, and in time, markets over most time periods go up more than, certainly as Sam has talked about, than savings rates will offer you at the moment. So they're definitely not worth writing off at the moment. The other interesting revelation from these figures is the gender breakdown. So actually more women than men hold ISAs overall, but they're far more likely to pay into a cash ISA than they are into a stocks and shares ISA. The number of women paying into a stocks and shares ISA is at just 21%. So it's up a little bit on the previous year that was 17%. But in comparison to men at 29%, 21% is not looking so good. So that's bad news in general, but also over time, if you think about what the compounding impact will be of that, of women paying more into cash where they're barely beating inflation and their money doesn't have the opportunity to compound and grow in that way, whereas men are more likely to put their money into stocks and shares ISAs where their money is working hard at the same time as they're continuing to put money into their ISA as well. Over time, that gender pay gap could start to increase. So it's a little bit worrying.
Rachel, do you have any idea why that might be? In the interest of full disclosure, I have both a cash and a stocks and shares ISA. But why is it that men are more likely to have an investment one than women?
It's a really good question. I suppose one answer is it is simply practical, that women are less likely to have as much disposable income as men. because of lots of different sort of life decisions, but there's a chance that they get paid less because of the gender pay gap. Perhaps they take more time out of work for caring responsibilities. So that could have an impact. They may be more likely to work part-time rather than full-time, which men are more likely to do. So lots of kind of practical reasons. And then there is a lot of discussion about if there are kind of other reasons as well. And it's something that I find a little bit uncomfortable, thinking that there are differences in the way that we should talk about investing to men and women. I mean, really, it doesn't seem like a gender issue. But one thing that does come up a lot in talking to people is that women may be more inclined to want to understand something fully before they jump in. Whereas men perhaps have been like, well, you know, I'm sure I understand, it'll be fine. Women are a little bit more tentative. And as a result, the kind of barriers to investing, which are there for everyone, the kind of obfuscating language around it, the perception that it's a little bit complicated, that it does take a little bit of time to kind of scour through and work out what to invest in and how to do it. While those barriers are the same for everyone, women may see them as a slightly higher barrier because they're less likely to jump in until they fully understand. It would be interesting to see whether listeners agree and what you think as well.
That was highlighted in the Great British Retirement Survey last year as well. We found during that research that 48% of non-retired men had a stocks and shares ISA, but just 18% of non-retired women were investing in a stocks and shares ISA. And again, that manifested in women being also much less optimistic about their retirement income as well.
Those are really interesting findings, and it does show some level of disparity between the risk appetite between the two genders. And I think, yeah, it will definitely be something that we'd love to hear our listeners take on. So if you have any comments on this, please do send us a message at MoneyWise Online on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. So the coronavirus pandemic has significantly increased financial pressure on households across the UK. Lower income households have been worse affected. Rachel Lacey, you've been looking into this a little bit. Can you tell us a bit more?
Yeah, we've been looking at the findings of some research by the think tank, the Resolution Foundation, and they found out that lower income households are actually twice as likely to have gone into debt and had to borrow more during the pandemic or dipped into their savings. And it just shows really how hard it is for lower income groups to weather the economic storm that we're in. Their research actually showed that somebody who had been employed in a sector that has been shut down through the period, for example, somebody working in hospitality would have savings, average savings of just £1,900, whereas somebody that had been able to carry on working from home with a higher household income would have average savings of more than double that at £4,700. Clearly, if people have got less money to fall back on, lower income households are much more likely not just to drain the savings that they've got, but also to need to borrow more. And the concern is that's often going to be with high interest credit cards or worse, payday loans. The research found that one in four low income households had had to borrow more, and that compared to just one in eight of higher income households. And I think as well, as we've covered in MoneyWise as well, that for sort of wealthier people during lockdown, people who haven't had a change to their employment circumstances, people who've just been able to carry on working pretty much as normal but from home, they've actually been able to feather their nest through the pandemic. You know, they haven't been able to go out and spend as much, and they've actually been able to pay more into their savings accounts.
So what can people who are struggling with debt for the first time do?
Well, I think the important message to get across really is that if you're experiencing debt problems for the first time and you're not used to this, is that there's very much a right and wrong way of managing the problem. And you know, the positive in this situation, if one can say there are positives, is that the government has basically forced lenders to be flexible with people who are having money problems. So, for example, lenders are offering payment holidays. And that's not just for mortgages, that's for credit cards and personal loans. And that scheme has been extended until the end of October. So I think it's much more important that people who are struggling with money take advantage of this flexibility rather than turning to credit cards, which might seem like an easier option at the time, or worse, again, payday loans, which I've mentioned before. Citizens Advice has said that some 13 million people have already struggled with paying a bill, and they are warning that demand for payment holidays is likely to be very high. So if you do need one, as soon as you are aware there is going to be a problem, get in touch with your lender to arrange it rather than leaving it to the last minute. The good news is that taking a payment holiday doesn't actually affect your credit record at all. But if you do leave it too late and you end up missing a payment, then that will have an adverse effect on your credit score. I think you can also, you need to think about your debt strategically as well. You need to be organised. You need to work out, for example, the first thing, work out how much money you owe and to who. Prioritise debts as well. Your mortgage should always be first, because otherwise your home's at risk. Pay your most expensive debts off first as well. You can look to reduce credit card costs by transferring balances, if possible, to a 0% balance transfer card. And then, of course, there's budgeting. You can look at your expenditure. You need to know exactly what money you've got coming in, exactly what money you've got going out. And I think that really, you know, when people are looking at cutting their spending, they often think, well, I mustn't go to the shops, I mustn't do this, I must stop buying that takeaway coffee, I must, you know. I think obviously you will need to adjust your non-essential spending, but I think what's not important to not overlook is cutting your essential spending, which can actually be easier than it sounds. For example, you can switch your gas and electricity, you can make sure you're shopping around for your home insurance, for your car insurance, and you can make really, really significant savings and reduce your outgoings without actually having any adverse impact on your lifestyle at all. So don't overlook those things. And obviously as well, if your circumstances have changed, is to find out whether you're eligible for benefits as well. And I think as a final point to say is to make sure you get some good quality advice as well. Contact charities like Citizens Advice and National Debt Line. And one thing they will all agree on is to not leave it until it becomes a really big problem. As soon as you're starting to worry about money, go out and get some advice.
Thank you, Rachel. That's brilliant advice. And if you'd like any more information, head over to the MoneyWise website, where we will signpost you to all of the different free debt charities that are available.
Now, Brianne, I understand that you have been looking into some potentially bad news for drivers, that car insurance costs could go up after lockdown ends. Now, what can you tell us about that, please?
That's right, Sam. So around 10.5 million drivers across the UK could see their car insurance costs increase if they decide to drive after lockdown. At the moment, people are still being advised to avoid public transport unless it's a necessary journey. And now that lockdown is beginning to ease and people are returning to work, there are a lot more people who are considering driving for their commute instead. In fact, 61% of UK drivers said they expect to commute by car when they return to work, compared to 34% who drove to work before the pandemic started. Now, the reason why they could see an increase in their premiums is because car insurance has to include commuting as part of the policy. Most policies, as standard, cover social, domestic, and pleasure travel. However, in order to be able to use your car for commuting, because you'll be clocking up more miles, it has to cover social, domestic, and pleasure travel plus commuting. The reasons why premiums could rise is because as more people start getting on the roads again, there's a higher risk of there being accidents which people have to claim for, and insurers factor all of this into what they actually charge you for an insurance policy. In April, car insurance prices fell by an average of £33 for new drivers, and that's because there were less people driving, therefore the risk of people getting into accidents was a lot lower. And some insurers, such as Admiral and LV, started to give refunds to people because they weren't even using their policies. Lots of cars were just sitting in driveways and garages. So unfortunately, although it is good news that lockdown seems to be easing and we might be able to enjoy the last bits of summer, if you are hoping to use your car after lockdown for commuting, you might see an increase in your premium.
If you already have a motor insurance policy that, say, is halfway through the year and you intend to start commuting as you weren't before with your car, do you have to tell your provider?
Yes, you do. Any changes to your policy, even if you're halfway through, you have to make sure that you let your insurer know, because it will affect what you get charged. And failing to let your insurer know could result in your policy being invalidated or your claim not being accepted. So if you are halfway through a policy which doesn't cover commuting, but you expect to start commuting when you return to work, make sure you get in touch with your policy provider and make sure that they update your insurance.
Okay, so for people that are perhaps a little bit worried by this news, and maybe they're a little bit uncomfortable with how much they're paying for their car insurance anyway, what can they do to bring down the cost of that bill, please?
There are a few things you can do to try and make your car insurance cheaper. The first thing is to not auto-renew. So if you're with a provider and your car insurance policy is coming to an end, don't just stick with them because it's the easy, simple thing to do. Unfortunately, loyalty doesn't pay when it comes to insurance. So it's important that you go out, perhaps use some price comparison websites to see what deals are available and potentially switch. If you find some deals, but you actually would like to stick with your current provider because they have great customer service or you just like the brand, you could actually use the deals you find as leverage to haggle down what you're paying at the moment. The next thing to do is to read the terms and conditions of any policy you have very carefully. You have to make sure that you're covered for everything that you need when you're on the road, and failing to do so could result in you having to pay more if your claim gets rejected because it wasn't included in your policy. Finally, one thing that can help instantly bring down the cost of your premium is to pay annually. This is because if you decide to pay monthly, it's almost like taking out a loan from your insurer, and they often add interest to your monthly repayments. So if you can try and pay it off in one lump sum, that can help bring down the cost of your premium. If it doesn't look like you're able to pay it outright, there are some options. You could get a zero interest credit card and put your payment on that, and then pay off the amount over, say, a 12-month period. So it's almost like you're paying by a direct debit. However, you're not incurring any interest.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Priyam.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the MoneyWise podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please leave us a rating and follow us on whichever platform you're listening on. If you have any personal finance questions, email them in to editor@moneywise.co.uk. You can also drop us a message on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at MoneyWise Online.